Fans of country music and country music television know him as Ronnie Brasco from Still the King, the half-hour TV show starring Billy Ray Cyrus. Nashville politicos didn't know what to make of him when he ran for mayor on the CHIT platform of corruption, hypocrisy, influence, and taxes. And at least one person thinks he's the guy who dumped a couch on his front lawn. But for those who find their home in the current that runs underneath Nashville's mainstream, he's Southside Johnny, the mayor of Wedgwood, Houston, a long-ignored industrial area of Nashville. Long ignored until at least a few years ago when it was discovered by real estate speculators and developers with really deep pockets. It's in the Wedgwood, Houston neighborhood where John Sewell stakes his claim. It's where, in 2006, he bought an old dilapidated house and put on punk shows there until he fixed it up enough to live in. And then a few years later, bought an old dilapidated meatpacking plant that he turned into a community space for musicians and artists and WXNA, which is a local people-powered radio station. And it's where he recently started publishing Salt Weekly, the physical manifestation of what he knows to be the future of print. But back in the mid-90s, John was a teenager who had just moved back to Nashville from Dallas. He was called Johnny G by the older kids and Troublemaker by the headmaster at the conservative private all-boys school he went to. And it was also when he discovered crass, hung out with some older radical Catholics, played drums in the band Murdered Minority, and faked a demo tape to get a show at Lucy's. You went to MBA.
Unfortunately.
Which is...
Does that need a backstory, context?
Well, because, I mean, that's so for people who don't know, it's a conservative, private, all-boys school here in Nashville. And at the same time, you were in a punk band called Murdered Minority. Was it difficult to navigate through your high school years? Was there some code switching going on?
I don't know. I dropped out after junior year because I was like, this ain't the place for me. It was a bad fit from the beginning. But at first, I just kind of kept my, you know, kept my head down and just did the work.
Did you go in as a freshman, ninth grade? First year, you're in there, you're doing the work, keep your head down.
Don't know anybody, you know, just go home, listen to music at home, do my own thing there. And that's when I kind of found actually one way of survive. So you had to do extracurricular activities. Like that was, it was almost like the school day is over, but you still have to stay here. And it's like, okay. That's how I found theater. So that was kind of like the reprieve from the nonsense there. But it actually did remind me one time I went there with James Crenshaw, and it was on a Saturday morning because all the buildings were open and somebody had done something to them. There were plenty of pieces of shit that go there. Right, and it's like kids that are like just turned 16 but driving like Porsches, Ferraris and stuff. You're like, why would you even do that to that kid? Because you have money to burn. Some of them had like pushed us around or something. So we went there on a Saturday and sprayed milk into their lockers. So by Monday morning,
a little stinky.
Right, we're doing nice. And I don't really remember how we get caught, because it's like I didn't really do much except be present. But then I have to go to some, they would have these meetings before school. It's almost like disciplinary meetings. And there I remember the wrestling coach kind of went off on me. And looking back now, I was like, oh God, it was kind of borderline. Like one of the other teachers had to stop him. Because he was almost like, and what else should we, because I was like, well, the guy is a bully. And, he pushes people around, and this is what happens, you know. And they were like, well, what else should happen? Maybe, like, during a wrestling competition, we should strip him naked in front of him. And I was like, no one said anything about stripping some boy naked. And I was like, that's in your brain, brother. But he kept going off, and it was kind of I started crying because I was like, I don't know what I'm being yelled at about, like, should we strip some dude naked at a wrestling competition? And that was the wrestling coach.
Did you get suspended for that? Or
No, because they couldn't really prove that I did anything. And that was the thing.
That's interesting. So how did they even know to pull you in?
I think they knew that I was with Crenshaw, and that I think maybe Crenshaw took one for the team because he was going down anyway. Because he had also gotten busted for some other stuff. And I think there was some stuff he didn't get busted for. But we still had to like appear at different things. And there was one time there was like a spaghetti supper fundraiser. And Stephen Brerin and I went to that, but dressed in all our punk gear. And I think I even wore a gas mask just to kind of put it. But we're like, we had tickets for our spaghetti supper. We're here to get it. And we're getting it to go. I think it was generally well received. People laughed at it and enjoyed it. Monday morning, Stephen gets called into the headmaster's office. And then Stephen, I saw him later. He was like, where were you? And I was like, not there. And he was like, oh, you were supposed to be. I was like halfway hoping maybe they didn't know that was me, you know, but there's how many punk dudes go here right now? And, but we were like, got in trouble. And I don't know why it was kind of like we didn't do anything. We didn't harm anybody. We just wore ludicrous gear to pick up our spaghetti supper.
Your weekend outfit.
There we are. Totally.
Yeah.
And then there was another time where it was like, we were all writing a letter to some teacher, like, happy birthday or congratulations. Or, and I was like, I wrote like, yeah, man, enjoy the time. You're a pimp. But back then I was doing pimp as like Snoop Dogg, you know, like, hey, to someone like, you're an interesting guy. I get called into the office for that. And so I had to explain like, well, there's a vernacular colloquial usage of this. I don't think that teacher is pimping out boys. I don't know all there is in the world, but I get called in for that. And it's like, but then there was another time there was like a bunch of graffiti that was done there. And when it was ascribed to me later, I'm convinced it was misspelled, but I get called into the office. Brad Joya like gets up next to me, like in the cafeteria, is like, hey, if you don't want to go here, you should find somewhere else to go. And I was like, but I was unaware of the graffiti. I was unaware of the vandalism. So I was like, I'm just getting like a cold call from the headmaster being like, inviting me to leave. And I'm like, about what? What's going on here? And I didn't even learn about that incident until like years later. And there was something that tipped me off that I think they had misspelled a word. And so I wanted to write Brad Joy and be like, you're talking to a spelling bee champion, sir. I don't know if they ever came forward, but it wasn't me. So that was kind of like frustrating because I was just like, fuck it. Yeah. So I got into a program at MTSU where you're allowed to take a certain number of college credits during your senior year, but I just didn't do the senior year part. So I was going to MTSU for like a year and a half. And then I got a call and they're like, hey, whenever got your diploma? And I was like, there's not one.
Oh, what?
And they're like, well, you have to have something. I was like, why? I've been going here for a year and a half. You know, like I have good marks. Everything's going great. That's when over that winter break, I had to go and get a GED. Later, so my stepdad, who's gone now, he went there. So he had friends there. So when he passed away, a lot of his friends set up a fund, unfortunately, at MBA to help pay for kids to go usually down to Memphis or New Orleans, do blues and jazz, studying and stuff. So at one of the very first get-togethers for that, my mom kind of gave Brad, the headmaster's wife, an earful. Because I look over there, I'm like, why is the lady moving? But kind of being like, hey, everyone around you is a piece of shit. Anyway, sad to hear that Pat's fund is at this place. We tried to get it at Vanderbilt, you know.
Yeah. When did you start coming to Lucy's?
It would have been 95 or 96.
And how did you find out about it, and who brought you there? And did you approach it because you had a band that you wanted to play there, or was there some other way?
No, came to just see shows. Because I remember when we had moved back from Houston, like I had just found punk. Like, and it was like, I think that's when I was like shoplifting shit from Tower Records or something. And I'd get home and be like, oh, this band sucks. So that's where I was like, all right, I don't like this Southern California stuff, but I do like this band, and they're kind of informed from this stuff. And there was a club in Houston, but I never went. I think Jacob, my brother, went a couple times. But I think when we moved to Nashville, I was like, is there an all-ages club here? Like, where do kids go? They go to Lucy's, and they have their mom drop them around around the corner so that you like pretend like you walked there. It's like, no, you didn't walk here from downtown. Or you're like, I mean, my mom definitely did drop me off in the van, if that's what you're trying to say. Around the corner? No. I was up there at the gas station. Yeah, and I was like, I don't remember the first few shows I saw there. I do specifically remember a Blank 77 show that was loud as all get out. And I remember it was on a school night, because the next day it was like, because that was kind of what I was mostly into, maybe that style. Well, it was like on like the old Epitaph, was it Epitaph comps? Anyway, the only band I really liked was Total Chaos. It kind of has that like politically informed street punk sound, but you still get to dress crazy. And I think that was kind of during that time period I started learning more, and I was like, oh, it got deeper and deeper. And then finally, obviously, Find Crass and that whole scene. I'm like, yes, this is where it comes together right here. But it is funny you talk about like the weekend wear, because just last night, thinking about this, I went through some old pictures and found a picture of me and Steven. We were NBA friends. We found each other there. And I have Chaos spikes, and he has a mohawk. But I remembered his style of mohawk, you could then part in the middle and drape down, because he kind of left the sides like with a little bit of hair. Oh. So it doesn't look like a mohawk during the week, right? So,
yeah. And what kept you coming back? Just the idea of coming to shows?
Coming to shows, the all-ages vibe. It's where you would find people like yourself. And be like, oh, you're weird too. What weird music are you listening to? You know, and then you'd be like, oh, okay. Because it's like, that was when you would get an album that you like, and then one of the first things you would do is see who they thank. And then you'd be like, all right, I'm going to find that band next. Because it's like, there's no like, unless you have Maximum Rock and Roll or something, like it's like really hard to find, you know, be like, oh, okay, this is where this scene is going, or these are members of that scene.
And where did the formation of Murdered Minority come in?
Let's see. I think Steven and I were going to shows on the weekend. Then we met James Cathcart, and he was driving in from Ashland City, and he had a couple friends. And I was really good friends with James Green, who was a bassist, and we would like ride around, and I think we just started jamming. Well, when I lived in Houston, I had a little band there. We were called Bulimic Pigs, as a middle school band would be called. And I think maybe we did a couple Nirvana covers, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
So we had that drum set that I'd gotten from a cousin. So then that was kind of the basis from building. And then we had a garage. So then Steven, he was playing guitar okay. He would come over, and we had a... There was this one dude from Atlanta. I totally forgot about it just now. His name was Lane, but he had that street punk look. So we're like, hey, what's your story? And it's like, you could probably play bass, certainly, decently enough for this outfit. But then later, I met my friend Marshall, and we're still really good friends. And it was one of those things where I think he was waiting outside for his mom. But I was like, well, I mean, you don't just want to be hanging out alone. And I think I saw that he had a button or a pin or something. I was like, okay. But I was like, he's from a different scene, but I want to learn what this world's all about. And so that's how we met. Just one of those things where I just like hung out, because he was just alone. And he was like, oh, I'm okay. And I was like, well, all right, I'm okay too. So we'll just be okay together until your ride gets here.
Yeah.
And I was kind of thinking about that last night. I was like, would any other all ages venue have fit that need in someone's life? And I was like, no. It was my conclusion, because so after Lucy's closes, then IndieNet is there, and it had a different vibe. I mean, it had the similar shows, but you got this older guy who's kind of doesn't even know what this music's all about, and why is he the guy booking shows? It didn't have the attitude as before. That was more community based, and I feel like that was really the thing that was great, because I would go to a bunch of shows, even if it were bands that I didn't care for, I didn't like the music. I was going to make a joke about, I probably didn't steal from Lucy's because you didn't carry the stuff I liked. I was like,
that's a good joke.
Right. But I was like, well, it wouldn't have had a big market anyway. You know?
Right.
And that was the mail order days mostly. But it was interesting because it was like a lot of the bands were bands I really didn't care for the music, but I enjoyed going to the shows and being a part of that and hanging out with people. And it's like even like the that some of that like weird metal stuff, like those were all my friends, and I enjoyed the and I enjoyed that they were committed to their music, but really I only have their record because they gave it to me or so, you know, something like that. I wouldn't have sought it out, but I think that was there was really like. It had that community aspect behind it, and it was like this was a place for everybody.
Your taste seems to run in, obviously, punk, but with a message.
Yeah, I would say so.
When you came to Lucy's, did you find that that was something that you could connect with other people about? Was there
totally.
Was there an activist element back then for you?
Yeah, there was, and trying to find...
What were you trying to do?
I don't know. That's what I was looking back. I was like, was I just rebelling against anything, you know, and be like, yeah, fuck the system. And it's like, well, what does that mean? Well, you know, burn it all down. It's like, yeah. And then what? It's like, you know, fuck the man. It's like, yes. But so that was where I want to say, and well, maybe I'd seen, From Ashes Rise and Process is Dead. And that's, I became friends with Brad from Ashes Rise, and he and I started doing, well, it was already existing, but we started running the Food Not Bombs program on Sunday morning. So it's like, oh God, what was that place? Hippie veggie place. They had all the vegetables. Anyway, we would go pick up their like sad vegetables that they couldn't sell. We'd get those Sunday morning, and they'd have a couple crates for us. Go. Then it was almost always me and Brad, and maybe someone else would help out, go back to our mom's house, make a terrible soup, and then go downtown and give it out. That was the deal. You know, that was what Sunday was. And looking back now, I was like, oh, was there almost a ceremonial, like, religious thing to it, you know?
Sure, yeah.
But so,
your church.
Yeah, which it's weird to think about that now. But yeah, so that's when I was kind of doing Food Not Bombs with Brad. I was also, like, getting more steeped into, like, all right, yeah, this world sucks, but there's a better world. Turns out you got to make it, though. I mean, there might have also been like a kind of a social element to Food Not Bombs. You're like, you're going to find the other like weird punk kids that also gravitate to that and help do it. So there's, well, just like church, mm-hmm. that family goes there. And, you know, but I feel like, you know, we're trying to do something more. And it's like, all right, serving a shitty soup on Sunday morning isn't going to change the world, but it's a step in the right direction. And it might be the only meal, but then we got shut down a couple times, and it was kind of one of those things like, really,
yeah.
really.
So, you know? So you were changing the world for that person that you were feeding, who
well,
wouldn't
totally.
have a meal that day,
right? And they knew they could show up on the steps at City Hall on Sunday morning, and there'd be something there.
Yeah. Who shut you down?
The cops.
And why? Like, what reason?
I think it's a health code, you know, thing. Like, yeah. you know, it's like, well, yeah, but it was also weird because then, ironically. Us being there might have attracted someone else. So then like some, you know, like religious groups would come and do their outreach there. And we weren't like, fuck you. You know, we were welcoming and because it was also our, here's more food. And I think they had like little to-go things. So it's like, you could have your soup now, but then they got sandwiches and shit you could have later in the day. But that was around the time also, there was a group called Anti-Racist Action, and so we became like the Nashville chapter of that. So we would organize protests and stuff and look super punk and holding a cardboard sign outside the federal courthouse, that type of stuff.
What was going on back then that you had to protest?
We did a lot of stuff against the sanctions on Iraq because we had fallen in with this dude named Carl Meyer. He comes from that, are you familiar with like the Catholic worker scene? Super like, well, I mean, really, there, a lot of them are anarchists, you know, mm-hmm. kind of lean socialists.
From the 60s, you mean?
Yeah. yeah. But even, they have roots even further back, but they're kind of like the radical Catholics. And he was kind of coming out of that tradition. And I'd looked him up recently. He was in like Chicago 68, like that was his scene. So he moves to Nashville, I want to say like maybe early 90s. And he's still alive. He and I reconnected a couple years ago because I was like, I wonder if Carl Meyer's still going and still surly as hell. He's one of the, you know, like he wants a better world, but still kind of, I've almost feel, I was like, is that where I'm going? Got a chip on my shoulder till I die, you know, like complaining about who didn't bring the shovel back to the shed, you know? And it's like, Carl, it'll work out. So he has a thing where he bought a bunch of lots next to each other and has a community garden, and he's been running it since the 90s. But he was also the local contact for a group that's probably, if they're still active, they don't do much, called War Resisters League. And they come from the, like, I want to say they come from, like, the pacifist tradition during World War I. We're like, to hell with your war. And he was running the local chapter for that. So we fall in with him. We went to some big protest with him and some of the older, like, ex-hippie people to D.C. There was, like, a day without the Pentagon. That might have been, like, 98. But we were, like, the young punk kids there. Yeah, so I invited Carl to one Murdered Minority show, and he came to no others. Because I think he was like, I get what you guys are about, but he's like, I don't like to listen to that.
What were you about? What was Murdered Minority about?
Well, really, we were initially, we were maybe, you know, Dead Kennedys, you know, would have been a big influence. But then we kind of just fell into more the ripping off, like, early peace punk stuff. So, like, the Crass record stuff from the early 80s. And that was a joke that I was telling someone yesterday. I was like, they were, like, mailing out a Cheap Time record that I was on or something. I was like, so how much you get for that? And I told him, I was like, well, now Murder Minority, I think I saw on Discogs, are going for $3 a 10-inch. And I was like, turns out the second wave of peace punk didn't really have a firm foundation. Because everyone's like, yeah, the first one was sufficient. But yeah, so it was mostly like, yeah, that kind of that anarcho peace punk type vibe. But then later we get more influence because as we got deeper into those scenes, like in the late 80s, so many of those like anarcho punk bands from England get into that harder sound, like more crust metal crossover. And we were kind of heading there in our last few recordings. So it's kind of like, oh, we're doing the same trajectory as like 10, 15 years ago. But yeah, so our first few shows is like, we definitely did a couple like Crass covers, which is all snare and jangly guitar. And I found a picture last night. We would do Fight War, Not Wars. And so it's kind of has a, there's a cathartic thing to it, but everyone gets to come up and do the gang vocals around the mic together.
Yeah.
But then later we did like a, was that a, like a Flux of Pink Indian song? But then later we're doing like Discharge covers. But that was the thing, is like, not, you know, we never really toured or anything. And so it's almost like I was kind of comparing it to Dave Willey, the guy, he was in Committee for Public Safety, mm-hmm. Nashville's first hardcore band, 1982 to 80, whatever. But I was almost like, oh, we were your version in the 90s. We didn't go anywhere, but we were the local opener for all the bands that we liked. You know, yeah. Like Oi Polloi came to town, we opened for them. Raw Power, you know, an old Italian hardcore band that was still playing, we opened for them. When His Hero would come through town, we'd play with them. You know, it'd be, I think we might have played the last two His Hero's Gone shows, because I think they were on tour. They played Nashville, and then I think we went to Memphis, and they played a couple shows, a couple songs, and broke up. So I was like, all right, well, we were there. Yeah. I did want to tell you one thing, though. When Murder Minority, because we had to submit a tape to get a show there.
Mm-hmm. That was what you had to do.
We just taped a 7-inch that I'd gotten in the mail. Because I was like, man, we don't have any gear to record on. But I was like,
wait, a 7-inch of another band?
Of another band.
Oh, my.
Yes. But it was like, we're like, and we didn't really like them that much. But I was like, whatever. And I was like, we barely found this 7-inch. No one else is going to find this one. Yeah, just hit record and turn it in. And
that's genius.
We had no other way, you know? So I was like, all right, yeah.
And it worked out okay, because you played Lucy several times.
A bunch, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's, I was looking at last night. I was like, some of the pictures I found were processed. And I was like, this might have been, I couldn't tell. I was like, the time might have been our last show that we played at Lucy's, which I want to say was like the January of that, of earlier in that year. But I'll have to find that calendar, but look it up. But I was like, this would have been around then,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Ut omnes muros eorum nostrum libertam prohiberat posceat. Solum una vox conjuncta facere eos cominuere potest.
Over the last 30 years, there's been a couple of recurring themes that emerge when people talk or write about John. The first is that a certain mischievousness informs everything he does personally, but it never gets in the way of what he does for others, which is the source of the second theme. John has made a real impact in Nashville by creating and nurturing a community for others. He connects creative people with other creative people and connects them all to the spaces necessary to do what they love. 10 years ago, when no one came to Wedgwood, Houston, before it was WeHo, he had a vision. And so he bought a building.
I had to tell people to keep driving past Greer Stadium. And they'd be like, what do you mean? I'm like, you got to go over the bridge. They're like, oh,
Greer
huh?
Stadium, for people who don't know, is where the Nashville Sounds.
Right.
The old Nashville Sounds Stadium. It's as far as anybody went.
Yep. I was like, you got to go past
to go
the baseball field.
Yeah.
Yep. They're like, what do you mean? I was like, no, get back there. And, but there had been some scene here at May Hosiery. They had, I think Fugitive had been doing stuff. Like there were studio spaces there. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of like, yeah, rundown industrial zone that was like ripe for opportunity and hadn't gotten the attention of really deep pockets. And so when I bought my house, I was working for like a remodeling company during the day, and then I would come and do my second shift there. And it was one of those things where I showed up one day, and it's like one of the few times where I just like broke down and cried. I showed up and someone had stolen the fucking front doors.
Oh.
And there was two of them. It was because it's a unique old layout, but it had two front doors, but they're from 1895.
Oh no!
So like hand carved and shit. Like the glass had been replaced with acrylic, which you know, but it was like.
Oh, that's
yeah.
So sad.
So then started building out where we live now, but for years it was the fun house. I don't know if you ever came to a show there, but it had no running water. You had pee and poop by the train tracks across the street. There was a hole in the kitchen. Everyone always talks about that. Like, yeah, there's a hole in the floor. I was like, well, there wasn't a floor, but I had to build like a little area. I was like, all right, get to the back. But we put on some kick-ass shows, kind of that like Infinity Cat crowd. We put on a lot of those type of things. This Moment in Black History played there. Times New Viking, like, and a bunch of others that I don't remember. Probably because I, you know, had adulterated. And then probably because some of the times I was like having to babysit others. Mm. I remember one time there was like a guy completely naked, like tripping balls. Oh, and I was like, dude, you're rolling around in insulation.
So you,
it's probably the least
point,
of your concerns.
You were the responsible adult
yeah.
in the room.
And
yeah.
It's like, God damn it. yeah. Well, so, to that, there's a direct tie in there. It's like kind of what was in my brain from what Lucy's was. You know, that was our thing there. It's like, I didn't give a shit if people were smoking weed and drinking there. Also, we didn't have a license to do anything. But it was like, we always try to have things that was open to everybody. Mm-hmm. And got a couple, you know, stop work orders out of it, which I hold on to with pride, you know, because mm-hmm. it was like, please stop running an illegal nightclub. But then I'd call.
That's all the words they had. They didn't know what to call it.
Exactly. So then I call them. And I'm like, then I was kind of like, well, I'm the owner of the building, and I let one of my people that are helping me build it out let their band practice there. Is that the problem? You know, like some yeah. fucking lie. But it's like, you're talking to some good old boy at Codes, you know, in 2006. Mm-hmm. That's the best you could do.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, okay, well, just don't do it again. You're like, okay.
So you buy another building. You buy the packing plant.
Right. It was a building that was a block away that it was falling apart. It had bad graffiti on the side, you know, like wasn't even cool stuff. It was like genitalia, you know, it's like, oh, how original, you know, maybe even a couple backward swastikas. You're mm-hmm. like, all right, some neighborhood kid thought he's going to shock somebody, but didn't even get it right. And so I wrote a letter to the lady that owned it because I'd found somewhere that she was the widow of whoever. So I was like, she's an old lady. She doesn't have time to fool with this damn thing that's falling apart. Wrote her a letter and I was like, look, I live a block away. I wanted to build out a space, and I wanted to also make a space where others can do something cool. Having run the Funhouse for a couple of years, I was like, I don't want to run a club or a venue. It's exhausting. But the first person that I showed the packing plant to when I was like, at first, I was like, here's what I was a guy named Ben Todd, and he's gone now. He was kind of like the generation below me. Yeah. That was coming up, and he ran Nashville's Dead, and they would put on an annual festival, put out records.
And that space was also in Wedgwood, Houston.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. They had the Glenn Danzig House, and it was interesting. After the Fun House, that's when Infinity Cat moves in over here temporarily into their house where they were for a few years, because there were still things happening at May Hosiery. And then later is when some of the art stuff starts coming in, and it's interesting too. But I got the building, and I was like, I don't have a master plan. I have a general concept. And so I texted something cryptic to Ben, something that doesn't give any clues away, but makes you interested. But he shows up with a couple people, because he's like, I don't know what's going to happen. You know, like, if you this older guy wants me to do something. And I was like, well, at least my text worked. You know, it got you here, because there's a big back room at the packing plant. And I told him, I was like, dude, I see shows happening in here, because it was very similar to the venue that he was running, but it was his house. But they were like, it kind of sucks. And I was like, well, yeah, because you have to clean up every night if you want to, before you go to sleep. And so
you have to get everybody out.
You have to get everyone
before
out
before you go to sleep.
Maybe, right. You know, like someone's right. Rooting around in something or still throwing up somewhere. But so he was the first person I ever showed the building to. He showed up with a couple friends, and then the idea was the big back room was going to be like the show space. And then he was going to take one of the front rooms to also do his like record distro and record label stuff. I was like, fuck yeah, that's exactly what needs to happen here. Then he passed away. And so it was, that was like, that sucked on many fronts, the least of which was what I'm going to do my building. You know, just like this guy was like a pioneer locally. And for some reason he looked up to me, you know? And so I was like, here's the next move, man. Maybe that answers the question. There was no master plan, but at least there was a concept. Like, provide a place for people like myself, where people are doing cool shit that I want to be a part of.
So what was the first entity that made the packing plant its home?
It would have been a pop-up in the front small room where Ben was looking at doing his record setup. And it was art shows. Mm. And it was like a younger crowd that was kind of... I mean, now they've all gone on to be, I guess you would say, I mean, not established careers, but they're rising stars in the art world. And they were kind of like a curatorial group that were putting on weird-ass shows. And I was like, here's your spot. Mm. And then also, actually, I didn't think about this until just now. Was it called No Name Fest? Catherine Edwards had, and that was... Well, damn, I didn't think about it till now. There was still no plumbing there at the packing plant. And they were doing this like punk metal fest in the yard. And I was like, yeah, do your thing here. And I think back then they were still, that might've been the pre-Dark Matter days. She was just booking stuff, maybe. Mm-hmm. But they booked that fest, and it was great, but there was same deal. There's nowhere to poop or pee here. Don't do it on the sidewalk. Yeah, so
it became a space for shows, art, music, and poetry too. Now
there's a poetry library upstairs. It's all filled out downstairs with like gallery spaces, but some of them, I guess you would say, they're galleries, but they're also, I guess, they're described as project spaces. Like stuff is not for sale, so it's almost like an exhibition space for like the weird outsider stuff that doesn't have a market, which is awesome. Rizology Club just moved in, so they do like their unique printing setup, which is pretty exciting, because I didn't want the downstairs to be so stale, like it's just exhibitions, you know, like there's actually somebody in there making something. But upstairs is now, there's the poetry libraries up there, an architecture firm, also WX&A is up there. But yeah, it was pretty interesting, because when we were first meeting with them to put the radio station there, I came home and I was like, I just got a check from Friends and Family of WRVU, because that was their nonprofit, was Friends and Family of WR. You know, so then my joke to them was like, I was like, do I have to return all those metal albums I stole from?
Oh my God.
Well, because I was like, but here's the thing. I was like, I took these albums. You could have never played them on WRVU, right? Like someone had gone through and programmed it and was like, do not play, do not play, do not play, do not play. And I was like,
you were just giving them a home.
I was giving them a home, but
where
also,
they would be loved.
I was also like, if you want them back, they're like, no, we don't need those You know, it's like, nuclear salt? Do you have a nuclear salt fan in your... Probably now you do, actually, but...
Do you have a show on XNA?
No, I don't.
Do you want one?
I don't know, because it kind of reminded me...
Do you need something else to do?
No.
Because you mentioned a lot of... well, we didn't mention it, actually. There were a lot of zines that were happening at the time...
Right.
Did you have a zine back then?
I did one short-lived thing, but it was like maybe like 98, because I remember looking, I found one copy of it, and it was just a bunch of collage work from like my MTSU catalog. It was ridiculous. You know, it was like, wasn't interesting, but I was like, but it was like, it was the days of black and white Kinko's at night type stuff.
But now, would you categorize what you're doing now with Salt Weekly as a zine?
I typically call it a zine to help, maybe help put people in that headspace, but then maybe I was like, also to set the bar low. So like, then they get it and they're like, it's not Kinko's Black and White. They're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because at least with every issue, we try to do something unique with the cover or have a unique printing process, because I was like, the future of print is not black and white. No one gives a shit about that. If you want to pick up your phone, like, you're going to see it in color with cool photos. Why would you buy the thing that's black and white newsprint? Back in the day, we needed that, and that was a cheap, easy way to get the message out. So I was like, the future of print for me is something that you enjoy holding in your hand. And so some of the things that we've done is something that are things that don't translate in photos. Like, it's a really interesting cover. It's a translucent cover, right? That's hard to capture on phones. The most recent cover that I just picked up yesterday, the Rizology Club did it downstairs. It's this, like, fluorescent orange. And they're like, it doesn't show up on screens.
Wow.
Right? I was like, Yeah. That's the future of print. But yeah, so now we do all the innards in color, unique printing things. The December issue last year was Dave Ramsey mixed with Egyptology. So he was Dave Ramsey's Chasing the Money. But he was, the cover is him shirtless, and it's a gold foil print. But the gold foil print is great because it was also done by an artist that used to work for him that I was like, I feel like you got this inside of you. You got to get this evil out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the gold foil print is unique in that the nipples and the teeth are a different gold from so they shine at a different angle than the rest of the gold.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things. I was like, I was trying to take a picture of it, and it didn't convey.
Yeah.
It's I had to take a video of me moving it through light, and so that light I was like, that's the future of print, and that's at least what we're trying to do with Salt.
And the content is.
There's original literature in there, drawings, doodles, comics. I try to encourage almost like a throwback to like underground press of the 60s and 70s, where the comics might be sexual or drug themed, mm-hmm. even though like you could do that anywhere now, but try to have that like tapping into that tradition there. Like, so it's almost like running for mayor. It's like there's people that remember that kind of like quirky activism where it's not just super serious. It's not just like, you know, like finger wagging all the time. It's like, maybe it has that spoonful of sugar with it, you know, where people are like, oh, okay, I see your message. Isn't just yelling at me about how I'm stupid. It also is like, hey, here's a funny thing, and here's a funny way to make fun of Dave Ramsey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like writing a hit piece on how he's terrible. Everyone already knows that. Show him as a dead mummy chasing money. That's interesting. I feel like. I don't know.
Well, you did run for mayor, not once, but twice.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Could your eyes roll back in your head anymore?
No, I'm the mummy.
Once was in the special election of 2018 to finish out the term of Megan Barry, and then again in the regularly scheduled election in 2019.
Right.
So art or not art?
Yes. All right.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, during your campaign, you did say that, you know, voters' response to your campaign run the spectrum from bewilderment to befuddlement and back again.
Oh, that's pretty good. I wrote that?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. But you did confound a lot of people during that campaign.
One of the best compliments I got was someone was like, I forget how they said it, was almost like, dude's nutty as hell, but he's not wrong. And that was part of the exercise where I was like, really telling someone, I was like, my audience wasn't looking at me. They were sitting next to me. Mm-hmm. So I could say something outlandish outside the window of acceptable conversation, have someone have the audience respond to it, be like, yeah, wait a minute. They hear that. And they're like, oh, there's public interest in, like, for instance, I was like, what's up with all these drug laws? Why don't we just, because I was like, decrim of weed, I feel like that should have happened 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. But I was like, what about decriminalization of all drugs? And people would be like, yeah, wait a minute, why not? And then if I'm like, say, followed up with like, they might be kicking in doors in Napier, they're not doing it in Belle Meade. People are like, yeah, wait, what's up with that? And it's like, all right, we just talk about double standards here.
Right.
Or we could just get rid of the law and cops can go do other things.
Yeah.
Like domestic violence or violent, you know, violence interrupting type things instead of chasing around. I was even like a decriminalization of sex work. I was like, what's it to you? What's it to you what other people do? Because I was like, we're not chasing down Lee Beeman's paramours. And so I'd say those things, and I was like, when I didn't think it was landing, that's when David Briley I think it was at backstage at a NOAA forum, but David Briley was like, I heard you were on performance enhancing drugs at the last event. I was like, I wasn't microdosing, but I wish I would have been. But going forward, I'll take that as I was like, you're a lawyer, right?
Is that campaign advice?
But that's, I was like,
you're a lawyer and has run for office several times. Is that a good idea?
But I was like, the fact that I'm able to like have a joke about microdosing when that was the second runaround. So he was mayor then. So I was like, I'm bullshitting with the mayor about psychedelics, mm-hmm. right? No one else in this town is doing that.
Yeah.
And this is back here. But also I think it was because I made it a point never to make personal attacks against any of the other candidates. That's not why I'm here. I'm just here to ask questions, kind of maybe the Socratic method on steroids. I mean, I remember that was the NOAA forum where the black preacher's up there quoting Saul Alinsky, and it's one of those things where I'm like, what? But I was like,
yeah.
I feel like he's talking to the back of my head right now, and, you know, being like, hey, because it was like where a lot of my message really landed was like kind of the old radicals.
Yeah.
It was the old radicals or like kind of like a younger disaffected youth crowd.
Yeah.
And I was like, these are the people that have kind of lost hope in the system. And so then it's like to kind of define what's a legitimate candidate by some arbitrary guidance that everyone's trying to find. The second time around, they upped it to 100,000. Mm. I remember that I was keeping tabs. And so I had this whole thing I was calling the criteria collection. We're like, this week's issue, the Tennessean requires you have raised $100,000 or have been in office. So I was like, are we calling this the Insiders Club yet or not? I don't, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was like, it was baffling to me. I was like, no one's been playing in this world yet. And it's, I don't know. It was kind of, and that's, well, that is when I met Daniel Pujol. Mm-hmm. We had never really corresponded before. He was kind of running that Infinity Cat crowd in the mid-aughts, where the local indie and punk crowd that had gotten a lot of attention nationally, internationally. And that was kind of one of those things where he was like, this is bad news, this entertainment business. Mm. But he went on and got like a master's degree in poli sci somewhere. But he saw me running for mayor and was like, dude, yes. And he got it, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's one of those things where I was like, here's the interesting thing. I'm not originating any of this. I'm stealing everything. And if anyone asks, I'll tell them where I got it from. Maybe it's from this weird Dutch anarchist group from the 60s. Maybe it's from Jello Biafra. Maybe it's from Dick Tuck was a Democratic Party operative. That, look him up. Great name, for one. But also, he was pulling some hijinks on a high level. And you're like, yes. So I was like, it's all there. No one's doing it, though. And it was the fact that there's also such a lack of knowledge of from people that have looked into it to be like, oh, this has happened before. We want our candidates up there. They either wear a blue tie or a red tie, and they do a lot of hard shaking of the fist, and they're going to say some buzzwords. It's so boring. Do you want people interested in civic engagement or not? Because that's not doing it.
Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for all the positive feedback and for all the great reviews. as well as all the pictures and memories that you've shared with me. If you have anything you'd like to share from your Lucy's days or from a place that you loved as a kid, send them along to @Lucy's Record Shop on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, or email me directly at mary@lucysrecordshop.com. Many thanks to Michael Eads for his time and for the use of his studio, and to Lamb Chop for the outro music. This show is brought to you by Give 40 the Finger Productions and We Own This Town, a podcast network of original entertainment and documentary content. You can find more info at the official site at weownthistown.net or follow @weownthistown on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Thanks again so much for listening.